I started very young as a kind of political activist. I came to anarchism in 1979, age 13. I guess the boffins here can do the math as to my age now, but I've been involved in kind of anarchist organizing since then. When I was old enough to leave high school, I moved to the nearest big city, which was Edinburgh. But if you like, by then, I'd already been involved in both specifically anarchist organizing and organizing other kind of campaigns, single issue things like the peace movement, which was a big deal in Britain as well as America in the late 70s, early 80s and such like. So when I moved to Edinburgh in 84, I already had kind of a few years of political activism under my belt, so to speak. To briefly give some of the context of what I'll be talking about, or the what was going on in Britain at the time. Again, in many ways, in the broader kind of political thing, what was going on in Britain in the 80s was, I believe, similar to what was happening in North America. You had Reagan, we had Thatcher, and that decade basically saw, which actually started in the mid-70s, I guess, after 73, but kind of accelerated the rollback of the kind of liberal consensus of the 50s and 60s that everything was getting better and wages were rising. And so in Britain in the 80s, this meant a huge attack on all fronts, on basically on the working class and their standards of living. Britain's much vaunted welfare state, which you're probably familiar with, again, was pretty much dismantled in the 80s. Again, I got free teeth and free glasses, for example. By the time, by 89, you had to pay for glasses and teeth. Well, it embarrasses me to say so. I went to university. Again, in my day, people of low income, of which I was one of them, were basically paid a grant to go to university. So in effect, I was paid. I was unemployed for a couple of years, and then I was paid twice as much money to go to university, which was brilliant. So I went to university for 4 years. Again, by the time I graduated from university in 89, they were no longer giving grants. They, by then, had come to an American system of loans and such like. There was a huge attack on organized labor in Britain, which culminated in 84-85 with the attack on the miners, who historically had always been the most political and combative, if you like, of the trade unions, and also were fucking huge. There was a quarter of a million miners in Britain in 1984, so they were also a numerically huge, powerful union controlling coal, obviously, which was the main source of power in Britain at the time. The miner strike was a huge deal in Britain. Again, myself and many others were actively involved in strike support in the miner strike, and actually this small town where I grew up, Stirling, was the first pit that actually went on strike. It was called Paul Mays, was the name of the pit. The first pit that went on strike and the last pit to go back in 85. So I say there's a kind of a track across the board on, again, the situation in Britain. By the mid-80s, we had officially about 15% unemployment, which meant in reality unemployment in Scotland was actually about 25%. So again, there was not only massive unemployment and poverty, but again, huge attacks on what little welfare was given to those people that were relying on the welfare state. So again, in the 80s, in my time in Britain, the categories for people that were eligible for unemployment, for example, used to be in Britain, in Scotland, you can leave school at 15, which most people do. Again, in the 80s, they made a law that you couldn't claim unemployment until you were 18, for example. So straight away, there was hundreds and more thousands of people that weren't eligible for benefits. They changed the way that you got housing benefit. You used to get housing benefit, which meant if you were unemployed or low-paid, they would pay a portion or all of your rent. Again, they did away with that. So again, I kind of across the board in the 80s, there was these massive attacks on the standard of living, which kind of culminated, which I'll talk about a bit later, with the poll tax, which was the most overt, if you like, attack on, or the most overt method of wealth redistribution upward, shall we say. As I pinted out before, Britain in general, and Scotland in particular, horrible poverty, all the kind of cliched indexes of poverty, we kind of led the way in Western Europe and Scotland. Highest rates of heart disease, alcoholism. Edinburgh, where I lived, say, for 10 years. I'm sure probably many of you have seen Train Spotting, which had a very bizarre view of heroin addiction in Edinburgh. Edinburgh was a heroin capital of Europe. Heroin is a poverty thing. Because of the heroin, Edinburgh was also the AIDS capital of Europe because of the needles. It's very miserable in many ways. Perhaps at this point I should mention the hoary old question of class, which played a great deal of great importance in our organising. I must say it strikes me as a little bizarre here in America that while it strikes me that America is perhaps even more class stratified, shall we say, than even Britain, there's very little class consciousness, or even, shall we say, an awareness of class and what that actually means, and perhaps more particularly as organisers, how we take that on board. I'm going to be a bit of a bastard here and ask you a quick question. Can everyone who's either a student in higher education at university or college or has graduated, can they raise their hands? That, of course, includes me. So virtually everyone in this, except what, two or three people?
You say graduated.
I said,
hold a degree.
No, either are in college or have graduated. So that is one cliched indicator of class. According to the Wall Street Journal, which someone pointed out to me just last month, only 20% of whitey goes to college. Again, a college education is a huge indicator of class and brings with it all kinds of privileges, opportunities, which are not available to most. White folks, are the amount of people of colour in America going to college is even less. And while the anarchist movement here seems to acknowledge the role that, say, race or white supremacy or gender plays within the movement and how, people are willing to acknowledge that and acknowledge that that may bring privileges, may influence culture, and hence may change, skew, alter the way that people that have those privileges interact in their organising, interact with others. There seems to be a complete denial, or I don't know, denial. It's not an issue, class, which I, again, perhaps coming from more class-conscious Britain, find really bizarre, especially given that as organisers, as activists, and as anarchists, presumably we think that change is going to come because most people actually need change, and hence the motor of change will be those that actually need the change, which is the working class. But I digress slightly there. In terms of the kind of activist context of the 80s in Britain, there was a fairly vibrant, I guess, anarchist movement of various strands. There was three national anarchist organisations in Britain in the 80s. I was never a member of any of them. There was probably the most well-known, perhaps over here, was called Class War, which don't really exist anymore. There was Class War. There was another group which at that time was called the Direct Action Movement, and is now called the Solidarity Federation. And there was another group called the Anarchist Communist Federation, who are now, I believe, are just called the Anarchist Federation. So these were three kind of, if you like, formal anarchist organisations. They had membership, whatever. The biggest of which was probably the Direct Action Movement, which had about 150 members. Again, to give you some, I guess, how pitiful in one sense, numerically, these things were. Class War at its height, despite selling maybe 5,000 to 10,000 papers at its height, again, had a formal membership, I think, at its height, which was in about 1991, of 130 members. And the Anarchist Communist Federation, despite their claims otherwise, never had more than about 30 members. yes, no one said it was going to be easy. One of the advantages, if you like, anarchists have had, and still have, I believe, in Britain, over the rest of the kind of self-identified non-parliamentary left, shall we say, is that anarchists had a higher not only class consciousness, but working class membership, shall we say, which is to prove pretty important in terms of organising. Edinburgh class war, for example, I lived with half of Edinburgh class war, which numbered four, and I lived with two of them. So again, in terms of the indexes I threw out there, for example, pointers of class, none of Edinburgh class war were college educated, and all left school at 15, and hence were actually normal people. When I moved to Edinburgh the rest of the left in Britain, again, you're probably familiar with many of their sister organisations exist here in America. Probably the most numerical was the ISO, who have about 4,000 members at any one time in Britain. And again, certainly that was the case in the 80s, virtually all of whom are students other than their cadre leadership, who are all... The ISO in Britain at the time had 80 full-time paid organisers, again, two of which were in Edinburgh. Secondly, there was another Trotskyist group called Militant, who technically were the youth wing of the Labour Party, though they were, to use a kind of leftist jargon, they were entryists. They tried to enter into the Labour Party to take it over, and they were eventually expelled, actually, in the 90s. But they were somewhat different from the rest of the left, in that actually in Glasgow particularly, they actually, again, actually had some working class base and support, so they were a bit different. There's also the other main leftist group in Britain was the RCP, who are, unlike the RCP here, are actually, again, a trot group. Maoists don't really exist in Britain, except for kind of the odd American transplant. And there was various other smaller, you know, Spartacists, again, who seem to be largely American, and various other folks. So that was the kind of the terrain, if you like, that when I moved to Edinburgh, which was in 84. Edinburgh had seen, and Scotland in general, had a history of pretty good kind of anarchist organising. Again, I didn't move to Edinburgh in terms of a vacuum. There was an Edinburgh anarchist group called Little by Little, which I guess summed up the diminutive, goals and aspirations they had. So there'd been a kind of bunch of specifically anarchist organising in Edinburgh prior to my arrival. And one of the benefits was there was a bunch of folks, some of whom were involved in these, again, former anarchist organisations I talked about, and other just kind of odd folk, many of whom were older. So there was kind of some continuity of more older, experienced activists, if you like. So I moved to Edinburgh, say, in 84, with the middle of the miners' strike, which was a huge deal in Britain. It was a year-long strike, insane levels of state repression, of violence, of... A gloriously heroic strike, which was horribly crushed. The miners lost, and now there are 25. I said there was 250,000 miners in Britain in 1984. Now there are 20,000 left, all of whom work at private pits. Coal mining doesn't exist in Britain anymore, for better or for worse. So shortly after I arrived, a group of these pre-existing activists and a bunch of new folks kind of came together, at first in a kind of ad hoc way, and eventually we settled on a name, which was Community Resistance. We were all anarchists or anti-authoritarians, though there was some argument that not everyone wanted to be called anarchists, so we never actually technically called ourselves an anarchist group, hence the title Community Resistance, because we didn't want to alienate people who were frightened or put off by the term anarchist. And pretty quickly we became fairly large and pretty well organised. We used to meet on Monday meetings, and typically at our meetings there'd be between 10 and 30 people. So we were fairly early on a pretty large group. The main focus of the group was twofold. One was doing what we called, I guess, solidarity work, which was largely strike support work, which I'll go into in a minute. And the other kind of half of it was more, shall we say, cliched or typical kind of propaganda work. So in terms of the propaganda thing, we would hold things like public meetings. We would, to our eternal shame, debate the ISO once, which is... I mean, again, it's something I fundamentally disagree with now, in the same way that I wouldn't debate a fascist, but nevertheless, I was outvoted in that one. I debated the Green Party once. We'd send out, you know, we'd send speakers to speak in universities and high schools. We would show films. We'd have discussion meetings. You know, so kind of more typical, if you like, propaganda work. And I'd say the other thing is we had a kind of solidarity work, which was largely based around strike support. What that meant was, if we would hear of a strike, which typically would be a wildcat strike, and hence was not supported by any union, so either the workers involved in that strike were non-unionised, or the union refused to support it because it didn't follow proper procedures in terms of balloting or union membership, we would get involved in terms of solidarity with that strike. The biggest one we were involved in, and the most, hence, spectacularly successful, was a bunch of women workers, of course they were women, who made lampshades in this kind of factory, sweatshop, whatever you want to call it, just outside Glasgow. And, you know, they worked in horrible sweatshop conditions, no ventilation, no breaks, shit wages, blah, 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 weren't allowed to go to the toilet, whatever. So they contacted the general kind of employees union in Britain, is the Trade and General Workers Union. So they contacted the T&G. T&G said, oh, yes, this is really terrible, join us, and, you know, it'll be really great. So they joined the union, promptly went on strike, and then the union, of course, said, oh, sorry, you have to be, for it to be an official strike, you have to union members for 12 weeks, so we can't support you. So for some reason, we knew one of the workers in this factory, or a friend of a friend. So we got involved in this strike, I say, as a kind of strike support group. The factory was basically contracted simply to make lampshades for Laura Ashley. I don't know if you have Laura Ashley in America. I think you do. That kind of stores that sell lampshades, I guess, and all kinds of things like that. So our cunning strategy in terms of winning their strike. So these women all went on strike and hence were promptly sacked for going on an illegal strike. So the strategy was that we would picket and put pressure on Laura Ashley, since they had the entire contract for the factory. So in turn, Laura Ashley would put pressure on the factory owner to reinstate the women, you know, open the windows, whatever, pay them real money, etc., etc. And that campaign actually lasted for about a year. And in the end, we won totally. So we started off doing pickets in Edinburgh through our contacts, largely through the kind of anarchist movement, so through friends, comrades in other cities. The pickets spread throughout Scotland, throughout Britain, eventually throughout Europe, and I believe perhaps even to America. And eventually there was such pressure and embarrassment, and, you know, it got to be start to get into the news, etc., that Laura Ashley did put pressure on the factory, and they won entirely. We were involved in a couple of other strikes, which again, we won. Actually, everything we did, it was community distance, we actually won, which is a part of our glorious strategy of victory. Which is really great. We were involved in some other activities. We did a bunch of anti-apartheid solidarity stuff. Again, as anarchists, we were prescient enough that we were wholly opposed to the ANC, so we didn't do any solidarity stuff with the ANC. But at the time, there was all this, I don't know if anyone remembers, again in the 80s, there was all this, within the ANC were in exile, within South Africa, there was all kinds of shit going on, including there was all these autonomous township committees that were basically taking over the townships, in effect the shanty towns where most folk lived. And so we did a lot of solidarity work with folk who were part of these. I mean, the main thing that we were doing was with this township called Alexandria, I believe, which is the main kind of black township ghetto thing outside of Johannesburg. So we did a bunch of solidarity work with them, again, pickets, educational stuff, sending them money, whatever. So I'd say we had 3 or 4 years of actually very successful, somewhat ad hoc, kind of anarchist organising, which was partly, again, was a kind of learning process for us. Pretty successful. And then in the I believe, I've not got the chronology completely right here, but in 87, the then Conservative government, Gerald Margaret Thatcher et al., mooted their kind of final pièce de résistance, the jewel in their crown of, as I say, this kind of upward wealth redistribution, which was what they called the community charge, which popularly became known as the poll tax. Again, briefly, what the poll tax was a flat rate and hence regressive taxation, which was levelled by the local boroughs or counties, whatever you want to call them, the local authorities, to raise money locally. So it was a local tax. So it was a tax raised by the local council, by, you know, Plainfield City Hall or whatever, to raise money for ostensibly local services, to pay for your street lighting, your garbage removal, your local police, your library, whatever. As I'm sure is the case in America, obviously federal funds greatly subsidise what local do. It's the same deal in Britain. And so this was a national tax imposed from above, but it was implemented, if you like, by each local authority, and each local authority would set their level of taxation. And previously, local authorities had raised money by a property tax, which is a much more, not egalitarian, but more egalitarian in that people heretofore paid tax on the value of their property. So if you were not a property owner, which more than 50% of Britain are not, you didn't pay the tax at all. And the dude that lived in Edinburgh Castle paid a lot more tax than some guy living in his one-bedroom apartment, which he owned. So I say this. So this previous property tax, which was called the council tax, was replaced by the poll tax. So the poll tax was a flat rate, regressive tax. Everyone paid the same, whether they lived in Edinburgh Castle. And it was every adult, so every person 18 or over, had to pay this tax. So if you had, you know, four students or perhaps a family of working class people who all lived, you know, with two kids over 18 or still lived at home in their rented or in the projects, whatever, they all had to pay the tax. Each adult over 18 had to pay the tax. So it suddenly meant that, you know, millions of people who hadn't had to pay this tax before had to pay it. You know, in hindsight, obviously, since we won that one as well, which we'll come to later, that was a big miscalculation on the part of the Conservative government. I say it was a stroke of genius in terms of their wealth redistribution plans. In terms of their tactical error, it meant this was the first time that they had done something which affected everybody. Previously, if you're attacking students or people on unemployment or, you know, minors or ambulance workers or teachers, you're kind of picking off people one by one. It's more difficult to get support to sustain a victory. This was an attack on everyone, and certainly given that most people either had never paid this tax or had to pay more tax than before, this was a huge, as it turns out on their part, a gross miscalculation. So Community Resistance, our, you know, mighty anarchist organisation in Edinburgh, when this tax was first mooted, in our infinite wisdom, we decided that we were going to, God damn it, we were going to fight this. We were going to start organising against it. So in 87, they passed a law. What's typical in Britain is that laws are passed a year earlier in Scotland than they are in the rest of Britain. So what they do is typically, you know, go to the poorest, most downtrodden, oppressed bastards and try out a law on them first. And then they modify it for England and Wales, you know, to see how it works, etc. So like with many other legislation, and actually the case of Northern Ireland is completely different. Northern Ireland is basically a police state where they try out all kinds of other bizarre shit. But Northern Ireland is governed very differently from the rest of Britain. So Northern Ireland didn't get the poll tax, for example, because they already had death squads. They didn't really need the poll tax. But so the tax was mooted to come into Scotland a year earlier. So basically we started organising against the tax a year before its implementation. And the implementation was, for the first year, what they did was compile the poll tax register. Because, I say, most people had never had to pay this tax before, they had to compile a list of everyone eligible to pay the tax so they could hence tax them. What this meant was, the main way they got the tax, where they compiled it, was through the electoral register. In Britain, the law is you don't have to vote, but it's a criminal offence not to register to vote, if that makes sense. Again, that's a very archaic, bizarre law, and before the poll tax campaign, no one had ever been prosecuted for not registering to vote. But suddenly what you found, because they're mainly using the electoral register as the way of gathering the poll tax register, you found people being charged for not registering to vote, being fined or whatever. So it was a criminal offence not to register for the electoral register, and it was also a criminal offence not to register for the poll tax register. So you'd have people coming knocking on your doors saying, you know, how many people live here, what are your ages, I want to verify that you are Ramsay Kinnan and you live here. And so our first campaign against the poll tax was campaigning against the registration. And again, our campaigning, which it was throughout the whole poll tax campaign, was cliched community organising. And again, what we decided, the Community Resistance, the Edinburgh Anarchist Group, was that it would be community organising. So what we did, which I'll come to a bit later, which I think was a grievous error, was in effect we dissolved Community Resistance. We stopped meeting on a Monday. And we thought the poll tax is such a big deal that we're going to stop all our other activities and concentrate on fighting the poll tax. So what it meant is, in effect, we dissolved this anarchist group to, this sounds kind of patronising and bizarre, but to go into the communities where we already lived and start anti-poll tax organising. So what that meant was, we divided up Edinburgh geographically as to where we lived and formed local anti-poll tax groups. So there was me and another guy, we're south side against the poll tax. And so depending where people lived in Edinburgh, since we lived all over Edinburgh, we formed these local anti-poll tax groups. And so we engaged in what I'm sure many of you are familiar are kind of cliched community organising. So the first thing we did to form our anti-poll tax group is we made leaflets and flyers, which we posted in our area, south side of Edinburgh. In the case of, you know, the group I was involved in, informing people what the poll tax meant, you know, what it would entail. And we're your neighbours, and we're holding a public meeting in the local church hall. And it was a church hall, which we'd somehow forgotten to burn down earlier in our activities. And so, you know, we fly-posted and said, you know, we're having a meeting in the church hall, whatever it was called, Saint something, I'm sure. And, you know, to form a local anti-poll tax group. At that first meeting, because remember, we were organising a year before they even started registering people for the poll tax, other than me and my... other anarchist comrade, two people turned up. So two of the community turned up, other than us two, but that was a start. It was the start of Southside Against Poll Tax. And then so again, we knocked on doors, we produced leaflets every couple of months saying what was happening, how you could, you know, what you could do against it. Which was somewhat tricky, as I say, because it was a criminal offence not to register. So we gave it information on ways to delay registration, how not to do it. But we didn't want to tell people at this point to break the law and get fucked, basically, over not registering, because in our, again, our great knowledge, we knew that the real battle would come over payment or not of the actual tax. So we were organising for a year, say, without any largely spectacular effects. Then, after the first year of registration, so this, hence, for 2 years of organising down the road, so we're now into maybe 88, 89, people actually have to start paying the poll tax. And then the campaign really kind of went ballistic. It really mushroomed, and a lot of people started to get involved. Our strategy from day one had always been to defeat the poll tax. It was going to be community organised and would be based on making the tax unworkable, i.e. non-payment of the tax.